A former Buckeye wins gold in Sochi. I'm Steve Brown.
And I'm Thomas Bradley. This is After the Score.
Welcome to After the Score from WOSU Public Media. I'm Steve Brown alongside Thomas Bradley. This week we'll look at the sexual assault case embroiling the University of Michigan football team and one former faculty member's allegations of a cover-up.
We'll also talk about the Cleveland Cavaliers' surprising midseason run and if it can translate into a playoff spot.
But first, a Buckeye wins gold. Natalie Spooner is the all-time leading scorer in the OSU women's hockey program. She was also a key member of the Canadian team that beat the U.S. in the gold medal game last week. It's been a crazy week for her, but we managed to get her on the line from Toronto. Natalie Spooner, welcome to After the Score.
Nice to be here.
Be honest, how many of your American friends hate you right now? All of them? Most of them?
I mean, I hope they don't hate me because I went to school with a lot of Americans, but I think they were cheering for me, but more so the U.S. team. But I think they were still happy that I won.
Yeah, the way that game ended was one of the more dramatic games I've ever seen in hockey, with you guys scoring two goals in less than 3 minutes and the one shot going off the post. What was going through your head in those last 3 minutes of that gold medal game?
You know, I was just trying to do anything I could to help the team try to come back. I mean, I had a few rushes earlier on, and they weren't going in for me, but I mean, I was a little nervous and scared, I guess, too, at the same time that maybe we would lose. But you know what? We never gave up, and we got some chances to get shots on net, and they luckily went in.
Was it tainted at all by some of the criticism of the penalties leading up to the end of the match? Some people thought the penalties were kind of non-existent or shouldn't have been called. Did that affect the win for you at all?
No, you know what? I don't think so. I think the calls all game long went either way. There was good ones and bad ones for both teams, so I mean that's the game of hockey, and you're going to get calls you like and calls you don't like.
So how big of a celebrity are you in Canada right now? Are you and the other team members the favorite daughters of the country?
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty exciting to bring a gold medal back to Canada. And, I mean, we got a pretty good welcome at the airport, which was pretty exciting. So, I mean, it's just great to be back here and to be able to bring a gold medal back.
You graduated from Ohio State a couple years ago, and now you're up in Toronto playing for the Toronto Furies. Talk about women's hockey in Canada and the professional aspect there. I think a lot of people would be interested to know, you know, what the life is of a professional women's hockey player in Canada.
Yeah, so it's a pretty new league. I play in the CWHL. So it's not really advanced. Like, we don't get paid or anything yet. So most of the girls that aren't in, like, the national team program will have regular day jobs. Girls who are in the national team program, we put more of our time into training and being ready for our big tournaments like that. So it's a pretty new league, but there's a lot of great players in it. There's a team out in Boston last year that ended up winning. They had most of the U.S. Olympic team on their team, so they were a pretty good team. But, yeah, it's great that we have somewhere to play once we're done college.
What else do you do with your time? If you say a lot of people have day jobs, what else do you do?
Work out a lot. Mm-hmm. This year we were obviously centralized, so we were busy the whole year. We lived up in Calgary and trained with the national team, but with the Furies, I mean, we do different events and public speaking and just things like that. But mostly we are committed to playing hockey, getting ready for the games.
We hear it a lot here in the U.S. that hockey is just incredibly popular in Canada. Just how big is it up there? You know, I think women's hockey kind of flies under the radar here in the U.S. If you could talk just how popular it is up there in Canada.
It was crazy to hear the numbers of how many people watched our final game in the Olympics. And, you know, just the feedback I've gotten on Twitter and Facebook and how many people have watched it, it's been pretty crazy. So I don't think I really realized how big it was until after the Olympics and knowing all the people that watched those games.
How much sweeter was it beating the United States, a country where you went to college and where you say you still have a lot of friends?
Yeah, you know, we have a huge rivalry with the U.S. like this, because Olympic years, we play them 6 times even before the Olympics. So you saw, I don't know if you saw any of the games, but they got a little rough even. There was little fights and brawls. So it becomes a lot more of a rivalry in the Olympic years even. So it was really, really nice to be able to beat them twice in the tournament then by the end. So It was just amazing.
Thomas is really mad at you right now. I wish you could see his face.
Natalie, we heard.
Sorry.
No, it's fine. Natalie, we heard about the problems in Sochi a lot on Twitter, and I want to get the athlete's perspective. What was your overall experience at the Olympics?
Yeah, you know what? I didn't see any of those problems since I got there to the very end. So I don't know who really experienced those, if it was more the media people, but we got there and it went smooth and our accommodations were great. I mean, the beds were a little small, but normal size for what you had as a dorm bed at Ohio State. So it's pretty much the same as that. So
No stray dogs or anything?
Pardon? Oh, no. There was a few stray dogs, but they were all pretty nice. They didn't like bother you. But
no more than...
I'd rather have the stray dogs than what I heard, like that people might have been killing them off before. So I'd rather have the stray dogs around there. We didn't mind them.
Well, it looks like Gus Kenworthy took them all home. So I think we're good in that regard.
Yeah, he got the little puppy ones. I've never seen the puppy ones around, but we saw a few older ones.
Well, we've been talking about the Canadian women's hockey team's gold medal in Sochi, and we've been speaking with team member and former Buckeye Natalie Spooner. Natalie, thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
In 2009, Brendan Gibbons was a freshman kicker on the University of Michigan football team when he was arrested for rape.
But he was never charged and stayed on the team until last November when he was suddenly expelled from the university.
UM administrators say there was a preponderance of evidence that concludes Gibbons engaged in unwanted or unwelcome conduct of a sexual nature.
And now federal officials are looking into how the university handled the incident.
For more, we called Matt Slavin from the Michigan Daily, the university's student paper that has led much of the coverage. Matt, Brendan Gibbons was arrested in 2009. He was never charged, but he was arrested. Why did it take 4 years for him to get kicked off the team?
You know, that's a question that a lot of people are asking in Ann Arbor right now. But it is important to note that the sexual misconduct policies changed a couple of years ago. To make it, first of all, there's a lower standard of evidence, and the standard of evidence is that there must be a preponderance of evidence to suggest that somebody is responsible. And a preponderance of evidence, if you don't know, means that a majority of the evidence must suggest that the party is responsible. So that means even 50.1% of the evidence could suggest it, or it could be 99, 100% of the evidence.
So
it's a lower... It's a lower standard of evidence, and the survivor of the sexual assault does not need to be involved in the process.
Matt, let's jump to December 2013. Brendan Gibbons does not kick in the Ohio State game. He does not travel to the Buffalo Wild Wings Bowl, and head coach Brady Hoke says he was dealing with an injury, and then he was dealing with a family matter. You know, talk about what your paper, the Michigan Daily, found out about the timeline of these events.
Well, we don't know for sure if there was an injury that kept him out of the Ohio State game. That's what the team said at the time. But the week before that in Iowa, on November 20th, the university found him responsible, no later than November 20th. And then 3 days later, this was before he was expelled, but he was still found responsible for sexual misconduct. And then 3 days later at Iowa, he kicked in that game, which ended up being his last game in a Michigan uniform. And then the next week was Ohio State, which he missed due to what the team called an injury. And then the Buffalo Wild Wings Bowl, Hoke said he didn't make that trip because of a family matter. And people here have kind of taken people have had a problem with that comment because some people feel it sort of evokes a sense of sympathy towards Gibbons when none really is warranted here. Some people think that makes it sound like there is a death in the family, and people aren't entirely positive if that if a family matter is accurate to describe what really happened. A lot of people say he should have just said, well, he's no longer a part of the team, he violated team rules, and that's all I can say on the matter. But saying a family matter is kind of suspect.
Mm-hmm. Doug Smith, a former pathologist at the University of Michigan, he's closely involved in this. Tell us about Doug Smith.
Yeah, he's a former pathologist here, like you said, and some people might call him a whistleblower. Some people feel that he is more of a conspiracy theorist. But back in August, he published a blog containing the police report from the incident, the 2009 incident. And the blog was mostly redacted, but he sort of was able to piece together who he felt the involved parties were. And we're not sure. He attended some regents meetings and gave the information. I believe he even gave Mary Sue Coleman, the outgoing university president, a photo of the survivor of the sexual assault. And so we're not sure to what extent, if any, that made the university pay more attention to this. But he did file the complaint that caused the Department of Education to begin their investigation, which was the big news earlier this week.
Why is Doug Smith a former employee? I don't want to insinuate anything that might not be true, but I did find it interesting he's now a former employee.
Right. I'm not sure. I believe his contract, I read somewhere his contract simply wasn't renewed at the end of it, and there were some disagreements between him and the university, but I'm not sure if it's fair or not to call him a disgruntled former employee, but his contract just simply wasn't renewed.
Let's jump to this week. You mentioned the feds are now investigating the way Michigan handled it, and there are now protests across Ann Arbor and on University of Michigan's campus. You're on the ground there in Ann Arbor. What is going on? The feds are investigating, and you know, what's your take on it?
Yeah, people thought that the administration did not handle this appropriately, and so the student body is a very activist student body. There are a lot of people on campus who care about these issues very much, and so it's only logical that there are going to be some protests on campus, and that's what we saw earlier this week when students marched to the Fleming Administration Building, which is where the president's office is, and their views differed. Some of them just wanted an apology from Hoke for calling it a family matter, and that's all. Others were more extreme and thought some people needed to be let go. A wide range of views, but definitely some unhappiness up here.
We should say Michigan has repeatedly declined to talk about Gibbons, specifically citing student privacy. A statement from a school spokesman, Rich Fitzgerald, confirms the investigation and says, quote, "We're very proud of our student sexual misconduct policy, our prevention efforts, and our programs to support survivors of sexual misconduct. We will fully cooperate with the Department of Education, and we believe that a review of our policy, programs, and investigations will conclude that the University of Michigan is doing what it should in this important area," end quote. Matt, what's it like? You talk about the protests and a lot of people disagreeing up there. Is it a divisive issue right now? Is it front and center on the campus right now? Is it what everybody's talking about?
Yeah, it's pretty front and center. Last week, there was a banner went up on our main campus building. I don't know what the equivalent would be over at OSU, but it's Mason Hall here. It's one of our main campus buildings. And the sign said something to the effect of that the administration defends rapists. And that banner was up for almost 48 hours, I want to say. So that made quite a statement. And people who were previously unaware of the story, that sort of caught their attention. It's definitely a divisive issue, and as long as whether or not the university can say anything is another matter entirely, but silence has frustrated some students even more, and so I'm sure students will continue to demand answers that they feel they're entitled to.
A guy's name who came up in the police reports early on a lot and is now actually at the NFL Combine preparing for the NFL draft is Taylor Lewan. Talk about his involvement in this case.
Mm-hmm. Well, all I know is what was included in the police report, which I've seen. He is alleged to have threatened the survivor of the sexual assault, and he had never commented publicly on it until the Combine, which was a week ago from last Thursday. And he said that he's never said those things, and he's the type of person who holds doors for women instead of threatening them, and that's not the kind of person that he is. And you'll remember after the Ohio State game, there was also some rumor of a fight at an Ann Arbor bar that he was alleged to have been involved in. And he also denied being in a fight. He said he actually was breaking something up and not fighting.
Matt Slavin is a reporter at the Michigan Daily. That's University of Michigan's student paper, which has led much of the coverage on the sexual assault scandal currently going on. Matt, thanks again.
Hey, thanks for having me on, guys.
Thomas, the Cavs are on a little bit of a run right now. They're not, it's not certain, we're not sure they don't stink still, but I don't want them to stink.
Basketball could be back in Cleveland, and that's with a major asterisk next to it.
The Cavs are 7-3 in their last 10 games, and they just beat Oklahoma City, the second best team in the league, so that's something. And Kyrie Irving is filthy right now. He's incredible, it's ridiculous, and I need a restraining order.
To see if the Cavs are for real or if they're just toying with Steve's emotion, we called Brian Dulick, and he covers the team for NBA.com.
Brian Dulick, welcome to After the Score.
Thank you for having me. It's always good to talk to you guys.
I think any conversation about the Cavs has to start with point guard Kyrie Irving, third-year player, MVP of the All-Star game. Is he the best point guard in the game right now?
I would have to say he's the second best behind Damian Lillard and probably right on par with Chris Paul. He's a magnificent talent. He's got the best handles in the league. That seems to be the universal opinion right now. He's not the best at setting up his teammates, but I think if you take the whole package, I would rank him number two behind Lillard.
The Cavs are currently the 10th best team in the Eastern Conference. The top eight make the playoffs. They're 7-3 in their last 10 games, so they're on kind of a streak. But they're still four games behind Atlanta for that final spot. Do you think they'll come back down to earth, or do you think they have a serious playoff run in them?
Honestly, I it's going to be very difficult. Their schedule in the month of March is flat out brutal. They have not seen Miami again. They'll see Oklahoma City again, San Antonio, etc. It's going to be very difficult. Plus, they've already lost the season series to Atlanta, which is holding down the eighth spot. Already lost the season series to Charlotte, which is the sixth, and still can be in play with Brooklyn. So they're really the equivalent of five full games out at this point with, 23 to play. I'm not really optimistic.
So
Allen is there, mind you. But there's no reason to believe in these guys because they have been so up and down and mostly down all year.
So is their recent win streak affecting their possible playoff spot in getting an Andrew Wiggins or a Jabari Parker next year?
They're kind of caught in no man's land because they're either going to be the very lowest playoff seed or they'll probably wind up with like the eighth or ninth worst record in the league, and then you're really just taking your chances in the lottery. So this is really the worst of all worlds. Everything that could go wrong this season as far as the organization's plans has. It's really not gone well at all. And then heading into the off season, they've got some difficult decisions to make. And in particular, as we head toward free agency on July 1st, they've got to do some real gambling in order to clear cap space, which could wind up with the team actually being worse next year if things don't go their way. So this is really a disastrous turn of events that no one saw coming.
And you talk about them finishing in the 8 or 9 spot. That really is the worst possible place for the NBA, right? Because being terrible actually benefits teams.
In theory, it does, but that would also be the case only if you've got a front office that knows what it's doing and can make some shrewd draft picks. And really, whether you can win by building through the draft anymore in the NBA is another issue altogether. I have long believed it's not possible. And the only way to win in the league is through trades or free agency, with the obvious exception of the franchise player that you can grab. And we've had one of those, and they come around once in a lifetime, so I don't see that happening again for the Cavaliers.
And he took his talents to South Beach not too long ago.
Indeed he did.
You talk about the team has talent. They definitely do. They added Jarrett Jack, Luol Deng, Kyrie Irving is better, Deion Waiters should be better, same with Tristan Thompson. So this team does have some talent. Does Mike Brown survive if the team does not make the playoffs? Will he be back next year?
I sure hope so, only because this team wasn't just building from square one this season. They were building from the bottom of, like, the Grand Canyon, because Byron Scott did absolutely no coaching for 3 years, allowed just an air of entitlement to sink into the young players, and really dug a hole and created a culture of accepting losing. If he got 3 years and Chris Grant, who did a horrendous job for 3.5 years, got that much time, there's no reason for Mike not to get at least another year. This is clearly not his fault. I don't think people understand just what a mess this team was the last 3 years and how little growth they showed just because of everything that was put in place by Scott and Grant.
Brian, we talked a lot about next year's draft, but last year's draft, the Cavs took Anthony Bennett, who is now up to about averaging 7 points a game, but he's been largely disappointing this year. Is it safe to call him a bust, or does he have a future in him with the Cavs?
Well, he's got a future with the Cavs because I don't see any reason for another team to take him off their hands. He doesn't have a position. He's clearly not big enough, strong enough, or a good enough defender to play power forward. He's not quick enough or skilled enough to play small forward.
He is fat enough, though. Oh, he's definitely fat enough.
He definitely is. I think they should play the hey, hey, hey for Fat Albert every time he makes a basket. The problem with the Bennett pick, there were really only two players in the draft that you knew would be radioactive, awful picks, Bennett and Alex Len. And Chris Grant zeroed in on Bennett and Alex Len for the number one pick. It's really unfortunate because Grant had the whole mindset, and really so does David Griffin, the acting GM, and the leftover of the staff, that they are always the smartest guys in the room. And, you get into trouble with people like that. They always tried to prove that they knew more than everyone else. The reason they didn't take Victor Oladipo this year was because that would be forced to admit that Deion Waiters wasn't a great pick. So they didn't want to look bad, and they went in a totally different direction. And, yeah, Bennett looks like a complete disaster. I don't see this ever working, to be honest.
Brian, our last question for you. We talked about LeBron James taking his talents to South Beach. Are they the team to beat in the NBA still?
I really think Indiana's got a heck of a chance since they picked up someone you're very familiar with in Evan Turner.
I am very familiar with them.
They had an opportunity, if they could grab home court advantage in the East Finals, to knock off Miami. Now by adding Turner, you hate to say that Miami isn't the favorite because of LeBron, but boy, this is I think the best opportunity we've seen in the last 3 years for a team knocking them off in the Pacers.
Well, Brian, thanks again for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Brian Dulick covers the Cleveland Cavaliers for NBA.com. And that will do it for this week's edition of After the Score. You can always find us at WOSU/AfterTheScore and on iTunes.
You can also stream the show on the WOSU Public Media mobile app or tweet us at After the Score. Until next week, I'm Thomas Bradley.
And I'm Steve Brown.